and welcome to Revolutionary Woman. My name is Tess Silverman. Women around the world are constantly creating ways to make a difference in their communities, and today's guest is no exception. Elizabeth Becker is an award-winning American author and journalist best known for her work in Cambodia and Vietnam. Her singular coverage of Cambodia under Pol Pot is the basis of the French feature film Rendezvous avec Pol Pot, Meeting with Pol Pot in English, that opened in Cannes and has received multiple awards. She began reporting in Cambodia during the Vietnam War. Since then, she has covered international affairs for 5 decades, including as a New York Times correspondent, the senior foreign editor at National Public Radio, and Washington Post correspondent. She was part of the Times team that won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of 9/11. She won 2 DuPont Columbia Awards for NPR coverage of the Rwanda genocide and South Africa's first democratic election. She has reported from all continents, including posts in Phnom Penh and Paris. She's the author of 5 books, including You Don't Belong Here, How 3 Women Rewrote the Story of War 2021, which tells the hidden story of women who covered the Vietnam War. A bestseller, it has been praised as a masterwork. The book received Harvard's Goldsmith Award, the Sperber Book Prize, and was named the Military Book of the Year by Foreign Affairs. Her 2013 book, Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism, also a bestseller, was an Amazon Book of the Year and was hailed by Arthur Frommer as a required reading about the future of global tourism. In 2019, Condé Nast Traveler named Becker one of the people who has changed how the world travels because of her book, and one of the most powerful women in the travel world for emphasizing a conservationist ethic in tourism. She's the author of the now classic When the War Was Over, Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge, originally published in 1986, won a Robert F. Kennedy Award. The movies Rendezvous avec Pol Pot and Bopana by acclaimed Cambodian director Riti Pan were based on this book. In 2015, she testified as an expert witness at the International War Crimes Tribunal of the senior Khmer Rouge leaders. She was a fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center, holds a degree from the University of Washington, and studied language at the Kendriya Hindi Sanstan in Agra, India. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the board of the Oxfam America Advocacy Fund. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to Revolutionary Woman. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming on the show. So I read that you were born in Denison, Iowa. What was it like for you growing up in Denison, Iowa, until you moved at the age of 12?
I'm fifth generation Iowan. The first group of my family came just before the Civil War, when Germans came in great numbers to the United States. So I grew up town of 5,000 with relatives in neighboring little towns. Mm-hmm. It was a small town, 1950s. Everybody knew everybody. I was very conscious of Germanness. Mm-hmm. My parents were the first of their families to grow up speaking English. The others had all managed to have German speaking in their home. So their parents and grandparents. So they would blurt out different German things at times. So the Germanness was there, definitely, and very Catholic. I went to Catholic school. Catholic church was important. Mm-hmm. So it was a small neighborhood where everybody knew everybody, a very farming area, farming before it became industrialized. So a lot of small farmers. And my father had a cafe.
Oh, wow.
That was the center of our life, the spot on Main Street. And I could make it sound idyllic, but it was essentially, it was just normal. Mm-hmm. We had to move in the end because the industrialization of agriculture is the easiest way to call it, when economics and government policy started in the direction of supporting big farms and supporting monocrops, so that rather than having a farming country where you had livestock in open fields and big kitchen gardens where farmers had orchards and grew vegetables, and we had great farmers markets. Nowadays, it's farmers are huge 1,000-acre farms, and they either grow feed corn or soybeans. So it's just not the place I grew up in, which is sad.
Oh, okay.
So when our cafe went bust, we moved out to Seattle,
okay.
Which was very difficult, but turned out to be a very good thing.
Huh. How different was your experience living in Seattle as opposed to Iowa?
Well, the difficulty was leaving.
Hmm.
And I'm one of six children born
oh,
in
wow.
8 years. We had very cramped quarters when we moved. We didn't have a nice house where, you know, we had more space. So it was cramped and we didn't know, you know, I was in seventh grade and it was, you know, parents had to really hustle. We were eight people in a one bedroom apartment.
Oh my goodness.
So that was tough. But they were very hardworking, and within a year we had a house and
okay.
So got on our feet.
Okay.
So but Seattle itself is a great city.
Okay. I have never been. I'm hoping to actually get there one day. So I read that as a child you wanted to be an artist. How did you get into writing?
Well, I wanted to be an artist, but I, as a child, like most children, you just do whatever's available. So sometimes I'd write, sometimes I'd draw.
Mm.
And by the time I got into junior high school, we're now in Seattle, it was easier to keep writing rather than drawing. You don't have art classes. We didn't have art classes per se. But you write in all of your classes. And before I knew it, that's what I was doing mostly. And so very much I concentrated on that.
So you were a senior foreign editor for National Public Radio as well as the New York Times correspondent. But prior to those positions, you were a war correspondent in Cambodia for the Washington Post starting in 1973. How long were you in Cambodia? And what was it like covering Cambodia during that time?
Well, I mean, to understand why I was there, I was in my undergraduate and graduate studies, I studied South and Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
It was not such a big leap for me to leave graduate school and go to Cambodia. I had already traveled and studied in India between undergraduate and graduate. So
okay.
It's not as drastic as it sounds when you just put it like that.
Okay.
And in my travels, I met another grad student from Columbia, Savannah Foa. She was on her way to Hong Kong to do graduate studies, and I was, you know, studying in India. We met in India, and I went back to Seattle to do graduate school. Well, she, instead of going to Hong Kong, decided she wanted to try covering the war, and she went for Vietnam and ended up in Cambodia. And she would write me letters saying, come and join me. And so that's what I did. So
okay.
It wasn't quite so drastic, and that's
okay.
How I got there.
Okay.
And she was thrown out for her really good reporting not long after I got there. So then because of my background, I was able to get a job right away for a now defunct news magazine called Far Eastern Economic Review, which was based in Hong Kong.
Mm.
And then not long after that, the United States, to everybody's surprise, mounted a massive bombing campaign in Cambodia. This is right after the peace accords were signed to withdraw from Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
And that left the American strategy vulnerable. So they were only allowed to have air campaign in Cambodia. They weren't allowed to do anything in Vietnam or Laos. So that's what they did to try to hold off a victory of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. So I was there for that and immediately
wow.
was picked up by the Washington Post, Newsweek, and NBC Radio. And so I learned a lot, and I was there for 2 years.
Oh, my goodness. You've written a few books, and one of them was turned into a film titled Meeting Pol Pot. Was this a separate trip where you actually met Pol Pot?
So I stayed in Cambodia for 2 years covering the war.
Okay.
I left because war is very hard to cover,
mm-hmm.
Emotionally, intellectually. And I didn't see that either side winning was going to work, and it probably would be the Khmer Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written the only article describing who the leader was and how scary the whole Khmer Rouge movement was.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to Washington, and then I started to hear all these stories about what was going on, that they closed off the country. Refugees said that they were destroying all the the elites and the authority figures from the old regime, mm-hmm. whether it's the military, the politicians, the intellectuals, the writers, the business leaders, all being killed. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I'm very upset.
Yeah.
And I, as a reporter who still cared about the country, I started, you know, writing to the embassies for that country under the Khmer, which is now called Democratic Kampuchea. So I kept writing and lobbying to get a visa because I thought I owed it, mm-hmm. you know, to go and try to see what was going on. And so I finally got a visa to go in December 1978.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. And so that's the movie Meeting with Pol Pot is based on that trip I made, and that's one chapter of the book I wrote called When the War Was Over.
Got it.
And that is the history of Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge. So that's only one chapter of this book that has been in print for 40 years,
wow.
almost 45 years.
Okay.
And so, and that's it. And the director is a very famous director, Ritty Pan, mm-hmm. and he was a teenager when the Khmer Rouge took over. So he was a victim. He was not one
wow.
of them. And both his parents were killed, and he lost half of his siblings.
Oh, my goodness.
And he became, after the Vietnamese overthrew the Khmer Rouge, he and his sister went to France as refugees where they had some family. Mm-hmm. And he became a very famous filmmaker in France.
Okay.
And wow. he was already been nominated for an Oscar 2017. Mm-hmm. And this film was premiered at the 2024 Cannes Film Festival uh-huh. and the 2025 Film Festival in Lincoln Center in New York.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, I actually just saw the film.
Oh, you did?
I did. I watched it last night, and very powerful. I mean, my goodness. I mean, I was blown away by the film. And while the film didn't outright show violence, at least for me, there were some scenes where I figured out that someone or people were killed. I mean, I was really, it was upsetting knowing that so many had been killed in the name of that revolution, or they called revolution. But I thought that the way the director, Ritty Pan, showed the viewer via film strips juxtaposed on the journalists' faces mm-hmm. was really brilliant. And I mean, I was just like blown away. I'm like, because I saw like, you know, what they were seeing, and I'm like, uh-huh. oh my gosh. I mean, what was your reaction to the film when you saw the film?
The woman journalist is based on me.
Yes, yes.
And so,
and I love Irene Jacob, by the way. I love Irene
Jacob. Yes. And she's a César winning actress, which is the equivalent of an Oscar in France. They took real cuts in their fees in order
really?
To play this.
Wow.
And the photographer is entirely imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the intellectual is based on one of the other men who was on the trip with me.
Mm.
So when I saw the film, you know, it's a feature film, so a lot of it is from his imagination.
Right. Yeah.
But the character based on me is more or less true.
Mm.
And I'm, in fact, the only one who's still alive. But
wow.
So I was gripped. It's like the honor of a lifetime that he'd made that movie, and he'd made it into a movie that said a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's so unusual that something that you lived through was worthy enough to become the subject of a big movie. And and I'm so happy it's streaming and that people like you can see it.
Oh, yeah. I really wanted to see if I could see it, so I was able to stream it. I was really gripped by the just the conversations between the journalists and your character really wanting answers. And she had to find out for herself what was going on. Now, what was that like for you while you were there?
Well, in fact, we did not find out exactly we did not see people being killed.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is that the other American who was not in the movie, who was replaced by the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
The other American and I, we we were the only two survived, and we went back to the United States. The intellectual was murdered just like that, and I did hide in the bathtub. That was all true.
Oh my gosh!
But what we were on the ultimate propaganda trip, where we only saw what the regime wanted us to see.
Right.
We only talked to the people that they wanted us to talk to. They locked us in our rooms, which you saw in the movie.
And that was
Because they didn't let us out. They didn't want us to see anything. And the difference between the other American and me was that his name is Richard Dudman. He's a well-respected diplomatic correspondent based in Washington, who mostly wrote about foreign policy and then would visit other countries. And he'd visited Cambodia before, but he'd not lived there. He didn't know the language. He didn't know the history, the culture much. And so even though we both saw the same thing, talked to the same people, literally, went through the same nightmare of nearly being killed. When we came back, he thought the revolution was working.
Oh, wow.
And I wrote, no, I saw, they showed us that what they called, what I called labor camps. Everybody had to be in what they called cooperatives. Well, they were labor camps. People just had to work night and day.
Mm.
They got small amounts of food to eat and no schools, no nothing. There was no life other than work. And that's, to me, like slavery.
Right.
So I said that, this revolution is awful. I saw no people who had anything to do with the life of the country before. Mm-hmm. A very rich culture, a very, no schools, no houses of worship, huge Buddhist community. Temples were all closed. Monks were gone.
Wow.
There was no marketplace. Nothing. Everything. The towns and cities were ghost towns. Everybody had to go to the countryside. So, we disagreed a lot, and he won the awards.
Huh.
But then the Vietnamese came in, overthrew the Khmer Rouge, and eventually the real story came out.
Yeah.
And I have to say that what helped a lot was the movie The Killing Fields. That was very good.
Okay.
But then the book that this is based on came out, I first published in 1986. So next year it will be its 40th anniversary.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So that's the whole history of it. And so it's just,
wow.
Ritchie was a young man when he got, Ritchie, the director, said that by learning how to make films, that's what kept him sane when he came out.
Wow.
So anyway, so that's the film.
Okay.
And but before that, after I came back, and then I married and had children. And while I had children, I was freelancing from home to raise them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to work as the senior foreign editor of National Public Radio, which was wonderful, but I wanted to be in newsroom again, writing newspapers. So then I joined the New York Times.
Right.
So that's how I got there.
Okay. Yeah. You've written a few books, and one of the books is You Don't Belong Here, How Three Women Rewrote the Story of War. It was really fascinating. Can you tell me what inspired you to write this book? Again, I was blown away by the book and how each woman made a commitment to gather their stories regardless of the challenges they faced.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't know when you're making history first of all. So all of us women who were covering the American Vietnam War, we did it because we wanted to, and there were all these hurdles, and so what, and so you just do it. First thing that happened was the media. I thought of what did it mean, so few of us women who actually were reporters and who actually worked. I mean, a lot of men and women would come through, but they didn't make any commitment to it. But the number of women who were actually covering the wars were just handfuls. And so I didn't know what that meant. And then something came up when I testified at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the defense attorneys who didn't have much, you know, the defendants, the Khmer Rouge senior leaders didn't have much on their side. Uh-huh. So they did what all of defense attorneys do. They try to make the person testifying mm-hmm. look like they're not credible. And so this defense attorney said, well, so-and-so professor, David Chandler, said you weren't qualified to write the book you wrote.
Oh, boy.
Because you're a journalist and not an academic. And so I had my book with me, and I was just read the blurbs. And, I mean, they're very good, yeah. if I have to say so.
Yeah.
And but she didn't let up. The defense attorney didn't let up. And so she said, blah, 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 blah. And so I finally said, the standard he used against me, that a journalist couldn't write such a big book. All through the rest of his career, he consistently put that aside, and he was known for easily giving blurbs to all kinds of reporters who wrote books. Hmm. And the only difference between me and them was that I'm a woman, the others were all men.
Wow.
Huh. And so the defense attorney, who happened to be a woman, said, thank you for that clarification, and sat down. And so then I realized, people don't know that women were, you know, who we were. And so then I looked it up and started researching. And I realized that essentially we're the bridge between World War II reporters, mm-hmm. All through from the first wars up to through World War II, women were not allowed on the battlefields.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Huh. Wow.
And most people don't know that because you think of all the famous women who were war correspondents, but they weren't on the battlefield. They had to sneak onto them. We're able to cover the battlefield because the United States under President Johnson did not declare this a war.
Mm.
And therefore, all of the rules and regulations about press coverage were thrown out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And women got in there without knowing they were breaking the old rules.
Hmm. Okay.
But there were so few, nobody really noticed.
Right. Yeah.
And at one point, General Westmoreland, who was the head of the whole military of Vietnam, MacVie, he was the head of all of it. He was out looking at troops, and he ran into a young woman named Denby Fawcett, who was freelancing for Hawaii newspapers. Mm-hmm. And he happened to know her because her mother, back in Honolulu, played tennis with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Denby, what are you doing here? And she mm-hmm. says, I'm reporting for I think it's the Honolulu Star. And he said, how long have you been here with this particular unit? And she said, two or three nights. And he said, thank you. And he went back to Saigon, and he said, women aren't allowed to be on the battlefield.
Oh, wow.
And the civilian side of the office said, yeah, but we don't have those rules here. And Westmoreland said, well, we have to have that. And so they talked him into a compromise where if the women signed an agreement saying they would not ask for any special favors, they could continue writing. Now, the women never asked for special favors, but they signed the paper.
Right.
And so then for the rest of the war, for the first time in history, women were covering the battlefield like men.
Huh.
And then that broke the rules forever. The next war, the Gulf War, women reporters just went along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they had no idea that we had been the ones who broke the rules and opened the doors for them.
Right. You had paved the way, you and
so that's why I wrote the book.
Now,
I'm at the end of the thing. I don't get there until 73. So I focused on the three women who actually were at the beginning.
Right, yeah. I mean, one of the ones that I really focused on, I mean, they were all amazing, but I thought the story of Catherine Leroy, was amazing. And the way, because of her stature, she was able to get into the fields without almost anybody noticing her, and she was able to take her photos. I mean, I thought that was extremely, extremely brave and dangerous, but I mean, she did what she had to do, just like you did what you had to do. So being female journalists, we're covering Cambodia, obviously you were treated differently, but has that changed, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely it's changed. Is it where people want it to be? No, but, right. Oh, of course. Look,
yeah.
Look at the bylines of the people covering the Middle East. I mean,
right. Yeah.
Look at the bylines of the people anywhere. I mean, the women are very strong in every aspect.
Yes.
On, you know, on your screens, in mm-hmm. you know, in your everywhere. So women are there. Now they will tell you that that's still not equality, et cetera, right. et cetera. Right. And then under the Trump administration, it's been horrible because yeah. his attack on equal rights has been horrific.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He calls it DEI, yeah. attack on that, yeah. but it's attack on equal rights. And so more women have lost jobs and more white men have gotten jobs.
Right.
And yeah. so that's a setback, but I hope it's not catastrophic.
Mm. Yeah, me too. And I hope it doesn't, you know, like last for too long because there's so many stories out there that are, I mean, yes, they're being covered, but so many women, like you said, have already like worked their way to be, you know, the journalists that they are. Not to be able to do what they are qualified to do, I think is horrendous.
Well, no, and it's in his targets.
Yeah.
It's obviously Black women. I mean, mm-hmm. it's so obvious.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with qualifications. It's he wants white men everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's bold and it is racist and it's sexist. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just out there. There's nothing else to say. He can call it anything he wants, but
right.
he's getting rid of women
right.
and yeah. minorities. And so it's the hardest on Black women.
Yeah.
Wow. But it's there. It's yep. he, you know, there it
yeah.
is. And
yeah.
It's horrible and you have to push back.
Yeah. Going back on your book, what challenges did you face while you were covering Cambodia?
I didn't feel it was obviously because I was a woman, but mm-hmm. I was often mistaken for somebody's daughter.
Huh.
You know, like I must be there because my dad worked somewhere in the embassy or something.
Uh-huh.
And once the ambassador, in one of his first, when the new ambassador, John Gunther Dean, one of his first press conferences, asked one of my colleagues to repeat his question because he was looking at my legs.
Oh my gosh.
It was that kind of thing.
Wow.
The other thing is that because there were so few American Western women, sometimes it just felt like too many of the males were too aggressive mm. sexually. And so I had to guard against that.
Yeah.
Wow. But in terms of my working with Cambodians and interviewing, mm-hmm. I think in some ways I was at an advantage
mm-hmm.
because I wasn't threatening.
Mm. Okay.
And also particularly with women, but on the other hand, men, the male reporters almost uniformly never interviewed women much.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
But also with men. I mean, I was not a threatening figure.
Right. Wow. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Who will you credit for where you are now?
Many people. I mean, you can.
Mm.
It's just a daisy chain. And I mean, from the beginning, some of the great reporters let me hang around with them and, you know, in Cambodia and learn. Great reporters, men, you know, I could just hang around and learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I go into the newsroom and I get mentored by this person and that person and hired here, hired there. I mean, it'd be hard to pull
yeah.
out, but you know, you start with my friend Silvana who invited me, and then reporters who helped me in Cambodia would be Ed Bradley from CBS,
oh, yeah.
David Greenway from Washington Post, many people from the New York Times,
right.
Particularly Jim Markham, my boss, Lauren Jenkins back then. And then in the Post, Peter Osnos was very helpful.
Wow.
Leela Skaz, who hired me back in Cambodia, very helpful.
Wow.
Oh, Johnny Apple from the New York Times, Karen DeYoung, who remains a good friend. It's just but
yeah.
there's everybody. I mean, I was, and whenever people ask, I said, you have more friends and allies than you realize.
Mm.
And it really helped me. You get help in ways you don't even understand.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's not one person at all. It's multitudes, crowds, wonderful crowds. By the time I started the book, both Kate and Catherine had died.
Mm. Okay.
And Frankie and I knew, and I got her permission to, she said yes, she would cooperate. And I got the cooperation of the people who were in charge of Catherine's whole work, all of her photographs and her letters, mm-hmm. and then Kate Webb's sister. Mm. So this was not how, it didn't affect me as a reporter per se. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to write a book about all the women who covered the war. That would be, I think, too encyclopedic. Mm-hmm. I wanted to concentrate on the woman who broke through and were extraordinary, accomplished, who arrived with nothing. And so in photography, it was Catherine. In long form, it was Frankie Fitzgerald, who wrote the classic Fire in the Lake. And then in short term, the daily coverage, it was Kate Webb, who became the first woman to ever be a bureau chief in a war zone. Wow. And then was so good that there now is the Kate Webb Prize. Mm. So those three really were, it was obvious that they were the best. Now, some others did mm-hmm. very well, but mm-hmm. They didn't come at the beginning, and they came with some, with a news organization. But these three came with nothing, wow. with a one-way ticket. Yeah. No jobs, mm-hmm. No place to stay, and had to do it on their own. And Catherine, as you said, she was in the field a lot mm-hmm. more than any other photographer at the time, in part because she was so poor. So she ate whatever the soldiers were eating and slept outside, and then she could just come back and live in a small room in Saigon. But she went on to be the first woman photographer to win the George Polk Award and the first to win the big Kappa Gold Medal Award. That's astonishing, yeah. astonishing. Yeah. Frankie, even more so. So she did great work changing the way the reporting from Vietnam by concentrated on the Vietnamese. She was not out in the battlefield hardly at all. Mm-hmm. She would go enough to see what was going on, mm-hmm. but she wanted to see how the war affected the Vietnamese, and no one else had done it then. She did reporting, staying at a village for a long time, and then writing about the village, going to the hospitals during the Vietnamese and how awful they were. And then when she just did a story about Saigon, she didn't talk about the beautiful French Quarter. She talked about the slums that were being built up because so many people were fleeing the war. So she went back. Mm-hmm. And she wrote Fire in the Lake. It was published when she was, I think, early 30s, 32 or 33. She won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the Bancroft History Award. No book before or since has won those three prizes.
Wow. That's amazing.
So just stunning. So these women really, really stood out and changed the way reporting is done. Catherine, by what the photographers look like, mm-hmm. how she concentrated on certain things. At one point, her stuff was so good it was compared to the best of World War II, which was and then Kate, she was couldn't help herself. She turned any story sort of into a personal story, and very, very literate, very well written. None of that hacky coverage. You could tell Kate had written a story because it was beautifully done, and she just raised the level of it all. And as I said, was like the others, very interested in the Vietnamese and the Cambodians, and so interested that she's the one who was captured for nearly a month.
So that's
the way, and that's the easiest way. And that, I mean, not easiest, but the for me, you really get to know the women because I got great cooperation. And at one point, I used the Freedom of Information Act to find out how her colleagues had turned against Catherine because she was doing so well, and they did not like the idea that a woman was doing it, that the women had no business being on the battlefield.
So they
went behind her back and talked to the officials in the U.S. embassy and convinced them to take away her press card, which would have been the end of her job. She would have had to go back to Paris. But one of her big champions, the head of AP photography, Horst Voss, pushed against that, and she got to keep her press card.
Mm.
And so that's what they faced. I mean, it's awful.
Yeah, that's crazy. Wow. Okay. Well, what's next for you?
I'm wrapping up a lot of work on the film. I'm going to Notre Dame this weekend for to show the film and answer questions. And after that, the weekend after that, to Long Beach, California, to the Cambodia Film Festival.
Oh,
and
wow.
Long Beach is the home of, I think, one of the largest Cambodian communities in the United States.
Huh.
And I have a couple more just writing projects, and then do a family memoir.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, so if anyone wanted to know more about you, your books, and the film Meeting with Pol Pot, how would someone go about it?
Well, I have a website,
mm-hmm.
elizabethbecker.com.
Okay.
And you can see the books, and then they will direct you to how to buy them. Meeting with Pol Pot is now streaming on Amazon Prime.
Right.
It's been to select movie theaters, but I think it'll be easier just to watch it on Amazon Prime.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a Substack, you should be able to find all those stuff that way.
Okay. If you had one thing to change that you wish you had done years ago, would there be one thing?
No, because everything built on something else.
Mm.
And I would not change anything.
Okay. My last question is, if you could go back in time, what advice would you have given your younger self?
Not to be so neurotic.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing your work and your life with me. And I really was blown away by the film and the book. When I heard about you on another podcast that I love, What's Her Name podcast, I'm like, wow. It's like the amazing stories from your book.
Thank you. Thank you.
And the women, I was just like, holy cow, I had never heard of these women. So this was just wild to like read about the stories of Catherine and Kate Webb and Frankie Fitzgerald and yours.
Thank you. And thank you for having the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate
good. Thank you.
Thank you. And have a great day. And I'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That's our show for today. I've posted more information about Elizabeth Becker on RevWoman.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in every other Thursday for another episode of Revolutionary Woman. You can listen to Revolutionary Woman on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Just a little note. I've launched a Patreon account to support the show. All proceeds will go to producing and editing the episodes to give my poor husband a break for being my personal IT and production department. He wrote this. The address is patreon.com/revwoman.